y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of child abuse, child sexual abuse, grooming, cults, religious cults,
radical religious beliefs.
Yes. So listener discretion advised.
On April 19th, 1993, FBI agents began pouring tear gas into a compound known as Mount Carmel in Waco, Texas. It was the final act of a 51-day standoff that had taken place between law enforcement and a religious group known as the Branch Davidians. After a failed attempt by the ATF to serve a warrant to arrest the group's leader, David Koresh, for stockpiling illegal weapons, the standoff began. By the end, 82 Branch Davidians were dead, including 28 children, and four ATF agents had been killed. The country was left with questions that remain unanswered to this day, the most important one being who was responsible for the 86 deaths that happened at Mount Carmel.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
Oh, man. This is a big one, y'all.
Woo.
I have been obsessed with Waco now for 3 years because I watched the Netflix dramatized series during COVID, like lockdown. And I was like, what? Like, I didn't know the details. I mean, it was 1993. I was little. You were even littler.
I was pretty little.
Mm-hmm. So we just didn't know a lot about it. And it's a wild one. I'm interested to know how many of you already know like a lot of details, or I wonder how many are learning about it for the first time. This way, y'all. But there's a lot of stuff you can watch on it. There is a Netflix documentary called Waco American Apocalypse. And then there's another one on Hulu that I just started watching. It's
Waco Messiah or Madman.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. It talks to some of the same people in the Netflix documentary, but there's more people in it, and there's a lot more information about David Koresh. It's very interesting. And even after we record this today, I'm going to keep watching it because it's just very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we do want to give a hey girl thanks, you know, really quickly to, do you know how to?
I'm going to say Lenron Purat.
Okay. I'm going to go with that because I just don't know. And we are so sorry if we are mispronouncing this, which I feel 99.9% sure that we are. And Kate Lindsay, I feel pretty good about that one, that I did that one right.
Yes. And of course, we have to thank Madison for writing this up.
Yes. Thank you so much. And this is a two-parter, guys. So we don't do a ton of two-parters anymore. We have done a few more recently. So what will happen is part two is going to come out next week if you are not a patron. And if you're not, that's fine. If you are a patron, so you can go to patreon.com/killerqueenspod. You can join. Even the lowest level gets part two, if we ever do a two-parter, immediately. You don't have to wait the week.
And it's ad-free.
Yes, and it's ad-free. Either ways, you're going to get it. It's just non-patrons get it next week with ads. And patrons get it right now ad-free.
Yes. So let's get into it.
Let's do it. All right. David Koresh was born as Vernon Wayne Howell on August 17th, 1959 in Houston, Texas. His mother, Bonnie Sue Clark, was just, I've heard 14 or 15 different people have said different things. She was very young when she gave birth to him. She had gotten pregnant by her boyfriend, 20-year-old Bobby Wayne Howell. Bonnie Sue grew up in East Texas with a father who was an alcoholic and a mother who wanted Bonnie Sue to live by the rules of the church. The family was poor, and in order to pay the tuition for her Seventh-day Adventist school in Houston, Bonnie Sue had to work in the school's kitchen during lunchtime and clean the school after class ended for the day.
A lot.
That's awful. She's a kid.
Yeah.
It's no surprise that Bonnie Sue felt alone and isolated from the other kids at school. Her school teaching emphasized the importance of God and was extremely socially conservative, particularly when it came to relationships between men and women. When Bonnie Sue reached her teenage years, she had developed a rebellious streak, which again, understandably so.
And common.
Yeah, like, come on. When she was 13 years old, she met Bobby. She ended up being expelled from her private school when the principal saw her kissing her boyfriend.
That's grounds for expulsion?
Yeah, doing regular teenage things. I mean, I wasn't kissing at 13 yet.
But I know a lot of people who were.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Who cares?
I knew people that were doing more than that too. But yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it's a kiss, man. And okay, if you are going to judge somebody for that because you think it's morally wrong, right? And this is a religious private school, then wouldn't you want that person to still be able to come to your school and receive what you are believing as truth and guidance and whatever? Instead, you're like, you did one thing wrong, you're out of here. What does that tell people? Well, if I mess up, what's the point, you know?
They're going to turn their back on me, yeah.
Yeah, like it's so the opposite.
Against, yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. In eighth grade, Bonnie Sue asked her parents if she could marry Bobby. And at the time, Texas had no minimum age for marriage as long as a judge approved. Bonnie Sue's parents, of course, said, no, thank you. And it wasn't long after that Bonnie Sue was pregnant. There are conflicting stories as to why Bonnie Sue and Bobby did not get married after she became pregnant, but ultimately Bonnie Sue ended up dropping out of school. So she gave birth to Vernon, who from now on we will just call him David Koresh, but that was his born legal name. On the morning of August 17th, Bobby was not at the hospital and essentially had no role in his son's life after that. So Koresh spent the first years of his life going back and forth between his grandmother's homes while Bonnie Sue worked. He was eventually enrolled in the same school that his mother had attended. And Koresh soaked up everything he could from the preacher at the school, who focused heavily on the book of Revelation and the story of the end times. When he went to church with his grandmother, he was super excited. At home, Koresh loved to ride his bike, shoot guns and quail hunt, or watch TV. When he was still young, Bonnie Sue met and married an ex-con named Joe Golden. Koresh was sent to live with his mother and new stepfather, and Golden abused Bonnie Sue and Koresh. Eventually, this man ended up violating his parole. He went back to jail. So Bonnie Sue files for divorce. Not long after this, now listen, guys, Bonnie Sue is only 18 at this point. Like, she was just so young. Yeah, not long after she divorces Golden, she accepts the marriage proposal of 34-year-old Roy Haldeman. And she decided to take Koresh with her and Roy to Dallas. When she went to pick him up from her mother's home, at this point, Koresh doesn't even know that this is his real mother. He thought that Bonnie's mom was his mom. He did not know. So just a lot of unrest, I think, for a young child.
Yes.
As Koresh attended public school in Dallas, he began to constantly hear the belief that the government and its democracy were evil. It was on the radio and the television. It was in conversations around him. Some people believe that this maybe was the beginning of his extreme distrust towards the government. And school was pretty difficult for him as a child. He could not read like his classmates. He was ultimately diagnosed with a language disability. And, you know, at this point, we would know it as dyslexia. But he was deemed, quote, slow at the time. And having a diagnosis didn't make reading or writing any easier. It just, you know, it didn't seem like they were helping with it. Yeah. So he continued to fall behind. But he had an excellent memory. Once he watched someone do something or he looked at a picture, he could remember how to do the task or the picture exactly. He was eventually put in a smaller class at school with children who also had learning disabilities. And of course, the other students made fun of him relentlessly. He was called names. He was bullied. And that kind of followed him throughout his entire school career. He did find one class he excelled in, and that was civics, where he got an A+. So, strangely enough, he loved learning about the government and what it meant to be a good American. He just hated the government. Koresh became even more of a loner, but he found his solace in music. Bonnie Sue finally gave in and bought him a guitar, which he taught himself how to play. He continued to be immersed in religion, eventually growing obsessed with the Bible. His half-brother said that he would sometimes find Koresh praying by his bed, and it would be like at night, and so he'd like leave or go to bed or whatever. He'd come in the next morning. He would still be kneeling in the same exact position, like he had not gotten up and moved.
That's at all. Crazy.
And this is a child. Like,
yeah.
It's, yeah. Koresh seemed to spend a lot of his time trying to impress his stepfather, Roy. And at this point, he had been cast aside by all of the men in his life. So he did everything he could to make Roy think that he was smart. Unfortunately, following rules and listening to Roy meant nothing to Roy. He was still verbally and physically abusive. Additionally, Koresh had been sexually abused by multiple other people. By 11th grade, he ends up dropping out of school. He meets a girl named Linda, and they began a physical relationship. And he finally understood at this point, like, what his friends were excited about and why they couldn't shut up about, you know, girls and sex and all that. Before this, he was just like, what's the big deal? Of course, Linda gets pregnant. So her father ends up kicking David Koresh out. I believe he was staying there, I think. Linda has a child, but she doesn't allow him to see their daughter. At this point, he gets pretty depressed. He starts attending different churches, looking to understand why he felt that God had abandoned him. You know, what happened? Where was God? He was concerned about his obsession at this point with sex and masturbation. In 1980, at the age of 21, while attending the Seventh-day Adventist Church, Koresh tried to convince the pastor that God had spoken directly to him. Well, the pastor didn't like what he told him, and what he told him was, listen, God spoke to me, and what he told me is I need to sleep with your daughter, who's a teenager. And look, I don't make the rules, okay? That's what the big guy said. Take it up with him. The pastor was like, a no, and you need to get out of here. Like, no. So he ends up being forbidden to see the daughter, which, good on you, pastor. You're protecting your child from a sexual predator. And he was leading some unauthorized Bible studies. And so the church was like, look, you can't do that here. You know, and as we know, he goes on to become a cult leader. So obviously he's not really sticking with what the church would want him to teach.
No. And also, I think it's just so insane to me that cult leaders that we have discussed, or that, you know, if you watch anything about different cults and things, the cult leaders always claim that they can speak to God directly, right? And all the message is always sexual in nature, with not always, but sometimes young girls.
Many times, I feel like, yeah. Or
young boys, you know, like young people that have no business. I just don't understand it. And the gall of somebody to be like, hey, I spoke to God today. And he was like, you got to give me your child.
Mm-hmm. And you got to give me your wife, too. And also, yes, you can't have sex with her anymore. That happened in Jonestown, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Bhagwan, too. Okay. Whew. Koresh heard rumors of a group of people in Waco, Texas, called the Branch Davidians, and they were dedicated to God. The Davidians' compound, known as Mount Carmel, was in the middle of a large open farm area. Their group is described as, quote, a spinoff of the Seventh-day Adventists, a religious group with beliefs based in Christianity. They believed that the end of the world was coming, and a former Davidian told ABC News in a 2018 interview that, quote, one of the things about being a Branch Davidian was you're supposed to separate yourself from the world. The world is the sins, the flesh, the desires of the world, and you're supposed to be spiritual. When Koresh first came to the Davidians in his early 20s, he confessed to the leader, 67-year-old Lois Roden, that he was concerned about what he deemed as, quote, excessive masturbation. He eventually seduces Lois.
She's 67.
He's in his early 20s.
Early 20s. You tell me, was he genuinely interested in this woman, or was he seeking to take her power? I mean, because, like, if you see pictures of her, she looks like a grandma. Like, she, you know.
These are not the same 50, in their 50s. I'm just thinking, like, nowadays, it's like you watch Sex and the City, and you're like, oh, shit, they're not the golden girls, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah, like, yeah. This is like somebody that it was old enough to be his grandmother. Mm-hmm. And
she was damn near 50 years older than him.
Yeah.
So he seduced her, and then he claimed that he had impregnated her, or I don't like it, or, quote, gave her his seed. I don't like it. Blech. I feel like I need to, like, mouthwash after that. I don't like that phrase, not one little bit.
Nope.
Apparently, she miscarried, which Koresh explained was because God was punishing her for, quote, squandering the church's money.
Or she never got pregnant because she was almost 70 years old. But he went and told everybody, look at what I've done. I have gotten a woman that is not in childbearing age anymore pregnant. That's how you know I am the Messiah. Nobody else could do it. Only I did it. Well, it's like, you could have also just said you got her pregnant. I mean, it's not like she was showing. Like,
yeah,
this woman was not pregnant.
Well, right. And the lies that cult leaders conjure up to be like, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
DCY.
Well, and like when she miscarried, he dropped her like a hot potato and was like, see, she doesn't have enough faith. And look, she squandered all the money. She doesn't have faith big enough to bring forth this child. So she can't be your leader because she's not faithful enough.
Whatever, dude. When Lois died, Haresh began a battle for leadership of the Davidians with Lois's son, George Roden, who, Torella said aptly yesterday, there needs to be a documentary on George Roden.
I need to know more. So much more about George Roden. Oh my gosh. Like,
first of all, I want to know where he buys his outfits. Oh. What's the look we're going for? Because it's interesting.
It's interesting. Yeah. I just like this story is so crazy that a character like George Roden, we just mentioned him in passing. And he's got a lot of stories himself, I think.
Yeah. We're missing an opportunity there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So Roden eventually forced Koresh and his group of followers off Mount Carmel. And the group took up residence at a nearby encampment. But meanwhile, a fire destroyed the large administrative building at Mount Carmel. Roden blamed Koresh, but Koresh said it was simply an act of God.
That's weird. It's super weird that God has the exact same like motives and enemies that you do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, he's not in charge of. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not his fault. Koresh ended up amassing more followers than Roden, and he wanted control of Mount Carmel, but Roden was not prepared to give up his community. So he decided to dig up the casket of a former branch Davidian and challenge Koresh, to a resurrection contest, with the winner being fit to lead the Davidians.
A resurrection contest.
Have you ever been in a resurrection contest? Because I'll tell you what, I have, and you haven't lived until you've joined or been a part of a resurrection contest.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm missing out then.
Well, I'm saying.
I was challenged once, and I wasn't sure that I could do it, so I sat it out.
Well, you know? And I, you know what that tells me? You don't have the faith.
Mm-mm. But you know, it sounds like what you're telling me is even if you don't end up succeeding, it's well worth the try.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a resurrection contest. It's just
literally, and like George Roden digs this body up and he tries to pray over it for several days to resurrect it.
How many times have we, like, the fact that that has happened enough to where I can be like, oh yeah, it's like
a llama, you know? And yes, yeah, like, come on.
So many
yeah.
people have, why?
So obviously he doesn't do it.
No, I mean, this cannot, it can't happen. I don't know if anybody knew that. It cannot happen.
Mm-hmm.
So Koresh, along with several of his followers, snuck into Mount Carmel in hopes of getting pictures of Roden digging up the corpse. And Koresh planned to bring these photographs to the police, but when he's trying to like sneak in there to get the photos, he and his group were caught on the property, and this led to a gunfight. The resurrection contest, that's out the window. Now we're in a gunfight. Roden suffered minor injuries, but Koresh and his seven supporters, were all tried for attempted murder. The supporters were acquitted while Koresh was set free by a hung jury. During the trial, Roden began to unravel, and he was held in contempt of court for refusing to, quote, stop staring during the trial.
Like, none of us, Madison, none of us could find what he was staring at, but it was obviously so disturbing that they charged him with something. Mm. And, like, it's written in articles and stuff. There's just not, like, what he was staring at.
Well, and again, I want to know more about, like...
I know. And that's not all he was charged.
Oh, no. But I will say this. One of my dogs, she has a very, very big staring problem. And I would like to hold her in contempt of court because I'm like, stop staring at me.
You can.
Leave me alone.
You can.
Okay.
Sue her ass.
She better lawyer
up.
And I'm going to arrest her. But so... He had also been charged with contempt of court for threatening a federal judge with having God, quote, sick herpes and AIDS on him.
That's not very nice.
I feel like if I was in SpongeBob right now, I'd be like, I do what?
Yeah, like, I don't.
It's weird. When he was released shortly after, he murdered another Davidian with an axe.
Oh.
Real gem, this guy. Roden was sent to a mental institution and Koresh was finally able to take over the group of followers at Mount Carmel. In 1984, Koresh married one of the branch Davidians. He ended up marrying a 14-year-old named Rachel Jones. 14!
And he's...
in his 20s.
Well into his 20s, yeah.
Yes. And she'd grown up with a family of believers. The couple ended up having two kids, Cyrus and Star. This began the rumors and allegations of inappropriate relationships with children taking place at Mount Carmel. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, not a friggin' rumor. But these rumors only strengthened throughout the years as Koresh was rumored to be sexually assaulting girls as young as the age of 10. And a former Davidian named Janine Buns had reported to an ATF agent that Koresh, quote, had fathered at least 15 children with various women and girls at the compound. Some of the girls who had babies fathered by Koresh were as young as 12 years old.
Do you know
how gross that is? Yes, I do.
Well, yes. So his thing that he told his followers was that he was the Messiah, right? And that God had told him that they needed to have 24 children. These children were going to be the next generation of like God's kingdom or whatever. But God had also told him that he was the one who needed to father these 24 children. They were going to be special, but he had to be the father. And they had to be conceived with virgins.
Well, and we're going to get into a little bit of that later, but it's always, see, this is the thing. It's so, I don't even want to say self-serving because that's gross. Like you should never, that should not be something that you should want out of life is to assault and take advantage of underage.
But it is self-serving. I mean, that's,
I'm just saying like, it's just disgusting to me that for him, that was like, oh yeah, I really, really want to get this done. But it's just amazing to me that, I don't ever want to say like, oh, I could never be in a cult or I could never, like, you know, life happens and I get it. But I don't understand with stuff like this, and they say it with such conviction and I guess authority and they're really charismatic, but all of the things that God is telling him, they're only self-serving. They're not for anybody else. They're only for him.
Right.
And nobody's like, well, why?
Hang on. Yeah, exactly. Because it's if you're saying, well, it's got to be virgins and who's virgins, but underage girls.
Yeah.
You know, because most of the grown women there are already married, right? They marry them off as quickly as they can or whatever. So, yeah, obviously that's like, oh, well, and I'm the only one that can do it, right? I've got to have sex with all these people. Like...
it's just outrageous. So Koresh eventually convinced the Davidians that he was the Messiah, the Lamb of God. And he said that God had spoken to him and told him that his job was to help them prepare for the apocalypse. Koresh said that there was a second coming and that he was intended to make the choices when Judgment Day come. But in order to do this, God had instructed him to indulge in sins so he could speak from experience. Convenient. It's convenient.
I don't think so.
I'm the only one who can know about this.
Yeah. Jesus did not give in to temptation, according to the Bible.
And he wouldn't have, you do it. Like, it's lies, but...
yeah. You got to do all these sins so you can tell people, I know what it's like. Okay.
He told Rachel that while he was traveling in Israel, he had a vision from God telling him to start having sex with Rachel's younger sister, Michelle. In 1989, Koresh, who seemed to somehow be able to attribute all of his questionable actions and decisions to the Bible, told all the Davidians that all of their earthly marriages were dissolved. So all the women now belong to him. And then he goes on to explain the Song of Solomon, quote, entitled him to 60 wives. Here's what you're talking about. 8 concubines and virgins without number. Some of the Davidians would not accept this, so they are like, we're getting out of here. Absolutely not. They leave the compound. But others stayed, and the men that stayed were expected to abstain from all sexual contact, including masturbation. the only person.
Yeah, they can't even have sex with their own wives.
Because they're not married anymore.
Nope.
And only David gets to do that.
Only David gets to do that.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, too. I don't know when Koresh decided to change his name to David, but I think it's interesting. I know that there's a tie for the name David to the Bible, but it's interesting. It's like the branch Davidians. And I'm like, oh, like, of course he would pick David. Because,
right,
you know what I mean?
And Koresh, I forget, Koresh has a...
There's a tie to it as well.
Has a meaning for Messiah or something like that. But yeah. One of the FBI people in one of the tapes, you know, because obviously the standoff was really long and they recorded all their conversations with him, whatever. One of the FBI people who had gotten on the phone with him was like, or ATF or somebody, I don't know. But he's like, hey, man, that's an interesting last name you have there. How do you pronounce it? And his answer was, you know, that last breath that somebody takes right before they die. That's how you say it. Koresh. Isn't that disgusting?
I don't know how to react to, like, I don't even know what words to say after what you just said.
And he pronounced his own name David Koresh. Like, he didn't say David. I'm like, it's David. He's like, my father in heaven calls me David Koresh. Like, just the way he said it. I'm like, okay.
Sure. But it seemed as though everything Koresh did was to assert his power and control over the branch Davidians. And he was charming. They always are. And because he had memorized so much scripture, he was able to twist the words to fit whatever he wanted. Mm-hmm. Again, they always do.
Yeah. And he had like a photographic memory.
Mm-hmm. Which is dangerous for this kind of situation.
Yeah. And so the people just believed because...
he could just spout it off like that.
Yeah. And so if you're talking to somebody and you're like, I don't feel like that's in the Bible, right? Like, I don't feel like it is, but I don't know enough about it to dispute it. You seem to know everything that's in it because he's spouting it off. And you're like, I guess he's right because he knows. Like,
yeah,
of course. And they also believe that he was hearing directly from God. But
right.
Just so manipulative.
So manipulative.
Hey, y'all. Did you know that we release an update all about us and what we're up to each week on our Patreon? It's called Tea to the Fourth Power Y, which is some time to talk to you, a nod to Not Another Teen Movie. Mm-hmm. And it's where we just gal pal with you about life, what we're watching, our love for Cracker Barrel Italian dressing. I mean, honestly, the sky's the limit.
You never know what you're going to get, really. Mm-hmm. If you want to catch an episode without being a patron, you are in luck. Just head over to killerqueens.link/TT. TTY, okay, time to talk to you, 4 T's and a Y, and you'll get to hear a full episode for free. And you can get every single regular release episode ad-free for as little as $3 a month. That's less than half the price of the coffee I get at Starbucks, so.
I know, that's crazy.
I know, what a deal.
Mm-hmm. And for $10 a month, you get all that plus our other two Patreon-exclusive shows, Murder Mixtapes, which is a full bonus case each week. Recent cases are Tara Grinstead, Hannah Cornelius, and New York Body Snatchers, just to name a few.
And you also get our other Patreon-exclusive show, Doc Jams, which is where we cover true crime documentaries episode by episode. We've done Don't Fuck with Cats. We've done Crime Scene on Netflix. They have Cecil Hotel and Times Square Killer. We've done The Jinx. We've done so many more. So be sure to head to killerqueens.link/TTTY to get your free episode and hundreds more episodes to download right now and binge when you become a member of our Patreon community.
A former member who was interviewed by the Waco Tribune Herald described an almost militant-like lifestyle at Mount Carmel. Quote, at 5:30 each morning, all the Davidians were awakened by the clanging of a bell. Everyone except for Koresh, who usually slept until about 2 in the afternoon.
Hmm.
These men ran an obstacle course, then spent the day doing hard labor. And while performing these strenuous activities, the drinking of water was not allowed. Why? The member described how Koresh would create rules at the top of the hat. Or the top of the hat.
A top hat. He's fancy. He's fancy.
He probably is very fancy, or was, but he would at the drop of a hat is what I was going for there.
That's the one.
And if the rules weren't followed, the member would be humiliated in front of everyone. And Koresh would hold Bible studies in the evening that would last for hours, sometimes all night long. Lionel Richie style, with no one, except for Koresh, of course, to be allowed to eat, drink, or use the bathroom.
Mm-hmm. And this included children. He made the children stay up all night while he did these Bible studies where he basically just screamed at everybody.
And humiliated them. And
yeah. And of course, like, he's awake, wide awake, and he's got plenty of energy. And all these people
because
are
he slept
like,
till 2 p.m.
Exactly. And people started being like, I think he's taking speed or something. Like, how is he staying up like this? But yeah, then he's crashing and sleep until 2 a.m. Everybody else got to get up at 5:30.
2 p.m.
Or yeah, 2 p.m. Everybody else has to get up at 5:30. Like, just all of these things are like, when you're looking at it from back here, you're just like, it's so obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And like, humiliating people that do the wrong thing, that's not biblical. That's not, you know, like, Jonestown did. Again, there's all these like threads that are common between these things and taking advantage of people who think they're doing a good thing.
Yep. Females that attended the Bible studies would basically, I mean, they would like hold their breath being like, oh my gosh, I hope after this Bible study ends, David Koresh is going to pick me to come to his room so he can, so they could have sex. But one Davidian, Kathy Schroeder, she described Koresh's room as quote unquote special. When Kathy was finally chosen after a Bible study, she was excited and she believed that she'd be alone with God through Koresh, that it was a private Bible study and they had sex, which Kathy said Koresh did for her, not for himself, to give her time with God. So selfless.
Yeah, exactly. And she's like, the room was just special. And like, in the Waco documentary, they recreate the way that she describes it. It looks like it's drywall that's not yet been painted. It still has the mud all over it. She said the bed took up 4/5 of the room. Okay. And that's all that's in the room, basically. It's just like a big ass bed and the walls aren't even finished or whatever. And she's just like, it's so special. And she tears up every time she talks about this because she's also in the other documentary and she tears up talking about this. How special it was for God to choose to spend time alone with you. And she talks about it like, he did this for me, not him, to give me my own sexual experience with my God. I don't remember there being any sexual aspect of like our relationship with God.
What makes me really sad, we were texting yesterday about this, is when I've watched a documentary about cults and somebody has survived it, gotten out of it. And I think, oh, thank God they got out of it. Like, thank God the cloud is lifted. And then sometimes you hear from them and you're like, oh, no, they still believe.
Mm-hmm. Kathy Schroeder is a big still believer.
Uh-huh. I'm thinking of two of like, was it Assembly of God, Children of God? What was that? T and Doe. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Was that Heaven's Gate?
Heaven's Gate. And there was that one guy who was like, I'm not worthy of this. And he had castrated himself. And then he leaves.
Oh, yeah.
But then they interview him and he's like, I'll never get to go to paradise now.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, oh no, he's like so upset that he didn't make the journey with them because he still believes it. It's sad.
It's sad.
So in 1990, Koresh filed a court document to legally change his name to David Koresh or David Koresh.
Koresh.
Yes. Oh, and here we are, another Bhagwan. Quote, for publicity and business purposes. The name David was in reference to the biblical king, and Koresh was the Hebrew translation for the biblical figure Cyrus the Great. Koresh had convinced the followers at Mount Carmel that he was the Messiah and that the apocalypse was coming, and all of the Davidians would die and be reborn, led by Koresh. In preparation for this attack, everyone at the compound had to be taught and were taught how to use guns, even the kids. Koresh and his inner circle of followers would purchase weapons at gun shows to stockpile them at the compound. They were breaking federal laws by converting semi-automatic assault rifles to automatic rifles and making live grenades. UPS, who often made large deliveries to Mount Carmel, reported an incident to the local sheriff's department when they saw a grenade hull fall out of a package that they were bringing to the compound. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the ATF, were asked to come in by the sheriff's department, and information gathered led them to believe that the Davidians had amassed at least 40 to 50 machine guns and 100 hand grenades, along with over 1.5 million rounds of ammunition. That's a lot of shit.
It's a lot of shit.
The end of days, Koresh said, would be brought on by an attack by the American government. Despite his rantings, Koresh likely had no idea that the end of days for the Branch Davidians would be as soon as it was.
Another interesting aspect that his followers were just like, okay, we need all these weapons. Okay, we need to transform.
Well, they followed him so blindly.
Yeah, we need to transform these weapons into automatic weapons, which we know is illegal. But, you know, he had this extreme distrust in the U.S. government, and he passed that along and put it all in their heads or whatever. But in an interview with Kathy Schroeder, she says, okay, if he was stockpiling weapons, because like at one point they kind of talk about how he's going to buy and sell guns at these gun shows or whatever. She was like, well, he was really just doing that. Like that started just to make extra money. That was a way to make money. We could, you know, we could buy and sell stuff and like make extra money or whatever. She's like, now, if he was going to the gun shows to buy these guns just to make more money, or if he was stockpiling these weapons to bring about the apocalypse by the American government, makes no difference to me. One way or the other, it doesn't matter, because we knew the end was coming. It didn't matter when it happened. It didn't matter if we brought it on or we didn't bring it on. And we knew that most of us were probably going to die. And while that was like kind of difficult to think about, at the same time, we were just like, well, that's what has to happen because he's God. But like, and even his aunt says, yeah, when he was young, he told me that the U.S. government was going to kill him. He knew that as a child, like as a teenager or whatever. And I'm thinking, but if you know that you hate the government and you're going to buck up to them in a violent way, you might be able to surmise that maybe you will be killed by the government. But people still viewed this as he's a prophet. You know, he said it was going to happen and it happened.
Yeah, but actions have consequences. And once you get that ball rolling, it's like, yeah. Okay, you, not that, now, we're going to talk more about it later on. There were some things that everybody could have done different. I'll just say that right now.
100%.
But it's like self-fulfilling prophecies. I don't know. Like,
right. Yeah.
Yeah. It happened. But guess why, David Koresh? Right.
Yeah. And, you know, he's trying to tell all these people these things and pump himself up and like all that stuff. And there were followers who were kind of starting to be like, I don't know. So some of them believe that he brought on this attack. He got the ball rolling so that the government would do something so that he could fulfill the prophecy and people would be like, oh, okay, yeah, he's the Messiah. Okay.
Yeah.
So the ATF had secured warrants based on information that they'd received regarding illegal weapons at Mount Carmel. In fact, they actually had an undercover agent at Mount Carmel.
Mount Carmel might be a better name for it, honestly.
Honestly, yeah. Mount Carmel for the past 6 weeks. This is ATF agent Robert Rodriguez. He had moved into a small farmhouse about 300 yards away from the compound on January 10th, 1993. He was posing as a college student who was really interested in Koresh's teachings.
That had to be hard.
I know, yeah. Later, Rodriguez testified that he'd never actually seen any of the residents at Mount Carmel with weapons, which I'm sure that they did a really good job of because he's technically an outsider. Like, they kind of welcomed him in and let him hang out there and stuff like that, but he's still not one of them.
He's not in the inner circle, that's for damn sure.
Yeah, so they're not going to just be like, hey, look at all these automatic weapons I have, or... I mean, I would think. I don't know.
They're not like me if somebody comes over and I'm like, and here's my play pockets. And then here's my tapes. And here's my, like, I'm like, let me give you a tour of everything that I have.
Exactly.
That yeah. I've collected. I'm very excited.
You know, they're going to be very secretive. Yeah. On February 28th, 1993, KWTX cameraman Dan Maloney received a tip that law enforcement was executing a raid at Mount Carmel. There are still conflicting stories as to where the information leak originated from. The story that I've heard most was that Maloney got lost trying to find the compound down.
Well, no. We're talking about how.
Oh, how Dan they even Maloney knew it came. You're right. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Yeah, because I'm like, I thought we did know that. Yeah, no. Right. And we always hear about this, right? Like, everybody in law enforcement is like, I wouldn't tell him. Mm-hmm. Well, somebody did.
And again, we'll talk more about it, but I do think there were a couple, like, this shit pisses me off because while I'm nosy and I want to know things, I don't think that the media had any business being there during the raid that, and one, you just keep going and we'll talk more about it.
Yeah. So they all are making their way to
downtown,
go check it out.
Walking fast, faces passing. They're headed to Mount Carmel.
Exactly. I mean, they want to catch the... It's a story. Of course, nobody could have foreseen what was going to happen, but still. So the ATF's plan for serving their warrants on Koresh completely and 100,000% hinged on the element of surprise. They knew that there were tons of weapons on this compound. If Koresh and his followers know they're coming, they will arm themselves. And it won't go well, right? So they have to not know that the ATF is coming. They were going to arrest him, seize all the weapons on the compound. Compound itself was 77 acres, and there were about 130 people living on the property, all of which the ATF assumed were trained in using weapons and would have easy access to them should danger approach, right? The Davidians, having no knowledge of the raid beforehand, was absolutely vital. I cannot stress that enough. They couldn't stress that enough. They gotta not know we're coming. So, normal day. Mount Carmel seemed pretty quiet. Cameraman Dan Maloney and the journalist with him had pulled over near the compound, but not close enough for anyone to see them. So they're waiting, and one of the reporters called Dan on the radio and told him that he was lost and he could not find where they were. So as he spoke to them, a mailman pulled up beside him. The reporter asked the mailman, how do we get to the Mount Carmel compound? And so the mailman kind of says, okay, it's over here, you know, whatever. And he's like, why? What's going on there? And he's like, oh, well, glad you asked. There's actually a raid that's about to happen. Law enforcement is on the way and they're going to raid the compound for weapons. And so the guy was like, oh, okay, cool. Thanks for telling me. So the mailman goes on about his route. He's moving towards the compound because he's going to deliver mail there. Oh, except he's a Branch Davidian.
So now the jig is up. Now they know.
The jig is up. Yeah. David Thibodeau was in his early 20s in 1991 when he first met Koresh at a guitar center in Hollywood. Thibodeau was a drummer, which led Koresh and one of his main dudes, Steve Schneider, to strike up a conversation because Koresh was like a really, really... really good guitarist and singer. They start talking to him, and just in conversation, I mean, this guy lives in California. They're in Texas. They just are like, hey, man, you know, like whatever. And so Koresh starts being like, you know, everything happens for a reason, kind of basically, and like God has a plan for you, and blah, blah, blah. And David's like, yeah, yeah, that's how my whole life has been up to this point. So he felt wholeheartedly just like that. I have to go live there with them. I'm following this guy. So he goes, and it's in one interaction, like it's just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So on the day of the raid, Thibodeau heard people talking loudly and he walks into the foyer and he found Koresh with Robert Rodriguez, who is the undercover ATF officer or agent. And Koresh was like shaking. He had dropped his Bible, like something's going on, right? So Rodriguez is like, hey man, what's going on? You look a little worried. Like, what's going on? He said that Koresh looked at him and said, Robert, the ATF or the National Guard will never get me. They're coming, Robert. They're coming. And he's like, oh, shit. Like, they know. And they cannot know. So he's like, but now they know. So he's like, I got a GTFO. Like, I cannot be here when this happens, right? If they had found out that he was an ATF agent, like, what would have happened?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because he knew they were fully armed and all kinds of stuff. So he's like, okay, I got to get out of here. So he walks out of the compound. He goes towards the farmhouse that the ATF had been occupying. And again, Rush did not know that at the time. Rodriguez later testified that he immediately called the tactical coordinator for the ATF raid and said, hey, they know. You've got to call it off. We can't do it today. We absolutely cannot do it today. And it seemed like who he talked to was just like not hearing him, because they're like, okay, well, what's he wearing? Is he armed right now? And he's like, none of that matters. You can't do it now. It's got to be called off. And they're like, yeah, no, we're going to still do it. Too bad. We're already close. We're just going to do it. We're just going to go. So agents appear outside. They're dressed in full gear. Their guns are loaded. They loaded up into two military trucks that were covered with canvas. One of the ATF agents inside recalled that the back of the trucks were packed full with agents, but it was completely quiet. It seemed like everybody knew that it was going to end badly. And it's really sad because these are people who have to follow orders and they're going like into the fire and they know it's not going to end well. And everybody has told, yeah, the people in command, we can't do it today. We can't do it today. It's not a good idea to do it today. They already know. This whole operation hinged on the element of surprise. And we've lost that. And you're going to say, never mind, let's just keep doing it, even though that was the whole thing.
Well, and does it suck that they tipped him off? Yeah, that's not ideal, right? We want to do it today, but this is like the moment where I was like, man, that really sucks. And I'm like, well, okay, now this really sucks. Like, just one bad thing after another happening here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah, it's the worst. And one of the agents said that, like, as they were pulling up to the compound, like, you know, it's totally quiet and they're all just like reaching back and like squeezing the hand of the person behind them. And they kind of like did that all the way back. It just seemed like they knew that this is not going to end well. So the compound was two stories and on an elevation with lots of windows. And this, of course, made it more dangerous for the agents to approach. They've got the higher ground. That's always an advantage. I have watched enough Viking TV shows and battles to know that. Like, come on. So agents approach the two white front doors of the compound, and David Koresh steps outside. He is shouting for the agents to get off his property. And one of the agents yelled back, we've got a search warrant. And so David Koresh goes back inside. He slams the door shut. And then gunfire erupted. To this day, it is heavily disputed as to who fired first. The Davidians, of course, say that law enforcement fired first. And the ATF says that the Davidians were the ones that started shooting. One of the agents later said, the very first gunshots I heard were from an M60 machine gun and a 50 caliber, neither of which we had as the ATF. Now, I don't know enough about guns to be able to hear something and know what kind of a gun or caliber is firing. I don't know. Kathy.
Schroeder.
Thank you, Schroeder. Later said that, like, when they got there, her kids were, like, just finishing breakfast or something.
She had just gotten them changed or something?
Mm-hmm. And the first thing that she heard was, like, when they came up, was the dogs yelping because the ATF agents were shooting the dogs as they came up to the house. Again, I don't know. And I would take just about everything Kathy says with a grain of salt, but I don't know. Every one of the Branch Davidians says it was ATF first. Every one of the ATF says it was them first. I don't know. Hand grenades were being thrown from the windows of the compound. The ATF had two ladders, which they laid against the front of the building, and they started climbing up onto the roof. Heather Jones was 9 years old and had been born at Mount Carmel and raised as a Branch Davidian, and her father was the mailman who had talked to the news crew and had come in and warned Koresh. Heather remembered being in one of the bedrooms when one of Koresh's wives came in with a gun. She, like, opens a curtain and she immediately flies back from the window. I mean, she's getting ready to shoot out the window, but she instead has been shot. And Wayne Martin, one of Koresh's closest confidants, who actually had a law degree from Harvard University, immediately calls 911. And he asked for Larry Lynch, the McLennan County Sheriff, telling them, there are men outside shooting at me, at us. And he's like, tell them to stop. There are women and children inside. Tell them to call it off. And we'll play a little bit of this call.
911, what's your emergency?
There are men, 75 men around our building.
Okay, just a moment. Just a moment.
Well, Miss Lynch. Hello?
Yeah,
hello?
There's 75 men circling.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, this is Lieutenant Lynch. May I help you?
Yeah, there's 75 men around our building and they're shooting at us in Mount Carmel.
Mount Carmel?
Yeah, tell them there are children and women in here and to call it off.
All right. Hello? I hear gunfire. Oh, shit. Hello? Who is it? Hello?
Call it off.
Who is it? Hello?
And that's a wrap on part one, dudes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So next week, or right now, if you're a patron, you know, we'll go into the actual 51-day siege in the aftermath.
The choice is yours.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're not a patron, ain't no thing. We'll catch you next week. If you are, keep it rolling.
But thank you, guys. We love you. Bye.
We love you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation.
Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud. Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.